In the previous episode, we focused on a heretic named Marcion. He was one of the first to articulate a spiritual tradition that came to be called Gnosticism, an early challenge to Christianity that anyone who's done reading on church history has probably heard of. Though Gnosticism ceased to be a threat by the opening of the 5th century, the term Gnostic is still applied to ideas that harken back to that ancient heresy. Now, the Montanism that we took a look at a couple of episodes ago is what we might call a movement within the church, while Marcion set up an alternative church to Orthodoxy. Gnosticism seems to have begun as a movement that ended up fostering its own churches. It's more a religious trend than a cohesive movement with a settled set of doctrines. While Gnostics held to a common set of core beliefs, they interpreted them widely. Now, that makes describing Gnosticism difficult. Generally, we can say that it was a mashup of Greek philosophy, Eastern mystery cults, and Christian terminology. From Greek philosophy, the Gnostics borrowed the dualistic idea that all matter was inherently and unalterably evil, while the spiritual realm was equally inherently and unalterably good. From esoteric and occult Eastern mystery sects, they took the idea that there was a, secret body of knowledge that, when understood, granted enlightenment. And this enlightenment was the Gnostic version of salvation because it liberated one's consciousness from mere physical existence into a kind of permanent spirituality. Gnosticism took its name from this idea of salvation through enlightenment. The Greek word gnosis means knowledge. Now, because the Christian movement was gaining popularity and growing rapidly at that time, Gnostics adopted Christian forms and terms as a kind of sneaky marketing ploy, hoping to pawn off their ideas as an elite form of Christianity. And the ploy worked. Gnosticism took root in several congregations, just as winds of false teaching do in every generation. Gnostics believe that sparks, or better, shards of divinity, that is, little portions of pure spirit, were locked inside some, but not all humans. And those that had them, they said, would become Gnostics. It was another clever marketing ploy. After all, who doesn't want to think that they have a little spark of something special? And so they were tempted to go Gnostic to prove that they did. Now, the next step was to pay one of the Gnostic teachers the requisite fee to learn the gnosis, the secret knowledge, so that they could have their divine spark fanned into full flame. Voila, enlightenment. It was an ancient version of, hey, the first lesson is free, but if you want to go deeper, well, that's going to cost you. Oh, and by the way, if you're smart, you will join us because that's what smart holders of the divine spark do. You want to be one of the special ones, don't you? Well, sign up, pay the fee, and you're in. Oh, and by the way, if you sign up today, it's half off. Okay, yeah, I made that last part up. But once you realize what Gnostic teachers were all about, we probably wouldn't be surprised to learn that they did have ancient versions of all the modern sales gimmicks. You know, family plans, buy one, get one free. For the Gnostics, enlightenment equaled salvation. They strove for the realization that they weren't mere humans devoid of the divine spark and so little better than animals. No, they were earthbound spirits destined to re-emerge with the divine hierarchy, that series of emanations from the supreme transcendent God. Gnosticism was a stepped progression of spiritual growth whereby members increased their rank by paying their Gnostic guides more and more to learn increasingly powerful gnosis, secret knowledge. And if all of this sounds eerily similar to a modern religious group that calls itself by a similar name, Scientology, well, there really is nothing new under the sun. Gnosticism presented a real challenge to the church for several reasons. First, the Gnostics used many of the same terms that Christians used, and that confused novices and those who weren't properly taught. It's something that pseudo-Christian cults do to this day. They use orthodox words, but they pour different meanings into them. Now, second, it's human nature to be attracted to that which is, you know, secret, hidden, mysterious. And quite frankly, that's what the Gnostics were all about. Third, they believed that they were superior to others. Now, this appealed to the ever-present pride indwelling the human heart. And the Bible teaches that humans were created in the image of God and originally destined for glory. there's a latent sense of a call to glory that lingers in the human soul. Greatness beckons us all. Well, Gnostic said that this was the divine spark, and only they could achieve it. A fourth reason is human nature assumes that something is important in salvation, well, it must be costly. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. The Christian gospel says that while salvation is by God's grace and free to us, it's supremely costly to God because it costs the life of Christ. But many miss this and think that grace is utterly free. The gospel's message of salvation by grace seemed thin and weak to those convinced that there had to be, you know, work involved compared to the Gnostic campaign of pay to play. What comes as a surprise is the realization that the first real doctrinal challenge to Christianity was not over Jesus' deity, it was over his humanity. You know, today, most controversy is over Jesus being God. It's easy to see him as a man. What's more difficult is to understand how the human and divine come together in the incarnation. And so this becomes one of the main points of contention with the cults. The Docetism of Marcion and other Gnostics maintained Jesus' divinity, but denied his humanity. And let me just give a little bit of a teaser for some of our later episodes when we get to the 4th and 5th centuries. It turns out that the battles that went on in the church over how to understand the dual nature of Christ became a supremely contentious period of church history. One of the church councils is sometimes called the gangster or the robber synod because those who attended beat each other with clubs over this issue and debate. Fun times. Well, back to Gnosticism. Other branches of the Gnostics taught that Jesus and Christ were two separate entities. Jesus was just a man with a human mother and father, while Christ was a spirit that descended on the man Jesus at his baptism, ministered through him for 3 years, and then departed in the Garden of Gethsemane. So the man that died on the cross, he was just a spent shell. His death accomplished nothing in terms of salvation. These Gnostics claim that the Christ spirit, or the Christ consciousness, continued to inhabit their leaders and could come upon anyone who showed sufficient enlightenment. Like Marcion with his abbreviated list of approved books that we considered in the previous episode, the Gnostics edited portions of the New Testament that spoke of Christ's physicality. They couldn't have him writing in the dust of the ground or eating after the resurrection because, well, spirits don't do those kinds of things. They also had to insert episodes into the Jesus story that gave an opening for their aberrant theology. The recent spate of alternative gospels that have made the news are for the most part Gnostic scriptures known to the early church but rejected for their spurious origin and dubious purpose. They weren't included in the New Testament canon because, well, they didn't meet the strenuous criteria used to validate accepted writings. Now, as I mentioned, there were several branches, streams of Gnosticism. They differed in all sorts of ways. One of the major divisions was on how to deal with their core belief in the inherent evil of all matter. One group believed that the proper way to deal with this duality was by a strict asceticism that avoided all physical pleasure. And so they ate only bland foods, drank tasteless beverages, wore uncomfortable clothes, and of course abstained from sex, and avoided any pleasurable stimulation of the senses. But the other tendency was a 180-degree reversal of that kind of asceticism. These Gnostics immersed themselves in physical pleasure. They said that asceticism was pointless because whether it was pleasurable or not, contact with the world was unalterably evil, so it didn't matter. And if it was all evil, well, might as well enjoy it. So these Gnostics made it their aim to so immerse themselves in pleasure, and this often meant indulging in the grossest kinds of immorality, that they would experience enlightenment anyway, and that would prove that their consciousness was distinct, divorced from their physical bodies. These Gnostics said that their divine spark was like a pearl that could not be stained by the muck of the world. Well, it's not difficult to determine which form of Gnosticism was more popular. Indulgence wins out over asceticism every time, except among that perennial minority that equates discomfort with godliness. Now, spread between these two extremes were other branches of Gnostic thought and teaching, leading to the diversity among Gnostics that I referred to earlier. Until the 19th century, most of what we know about the Gnostics came from Christian leaders like Irenaeus and Origen, who refuted their ideas. Here's what the early church father Irenaeus wrote about the Gnostics in his preface to his work Against Heresies. He wrote this, quote, "These men falsify the oracles of God and prove themselves evil interpreters of the good word of revelation. They also overthrow the faith of many by drawing them away under a pretense of superior knowledge from him who rounded and adorned the universe as if they had something more excellent and sublime to reveal than God who created the heaven and the earth and all things therein. By means of specious words, they cunningly allure the simple-minded to inquire into their system, but they nevertheless clumsily destroy them while they initiate them into their blasphemous and impious opinions. And these simple ones are unable, even in such a matter, to distinguish falsehood from truth." Unquote. Now, until recently, pretty much all historians knew of ancient Gnosticism was what its opponents said about it. But then, several decades ago, ancient Gnostic manuscripts began to surface. The more notable of these was the Codex Asuianus, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Wisdom of Jesus, and the Acts of Peter. In 1946, a collection of Gnostic manuscripts was discovered near Nag Hammadi in Egypt. They were dated to the late 4th century. Simon Magus, who is mentioned for us in Acts chapter 8, was labeled by early Christians as the originator of Gnosticism and may indeed have had a hand in blending Greek philosophy, Eastern mysteries, and Christian lingo into a homespun spiritualism. After Simon, another Gnostic teacher named Menander followed up on and elaborated on Simon's work. Saturninus brought Gnosticism to Antioch in Syria, where a thriving Christian community already existed. Cerinthus spread Gnosticism in Asia Minor, and as we've seen, Cerdo and Marcion brought Gnostic ideas to Rome. But the name that is most associated with the blending of Gnosticism and Christianity is Valentinus. Now, born in Carthage about 100, he was almost elected the Bishop of Rome. But it's a good thing that he wasn't, because not long after, he became a potent advocate of Gnosticism. His poetically versed Gospel of Truth was quite popular. As did most false teachers of the time, Valentinus claimed apostolic authority for his teaching. He said that what he shared was from a disciple of Paul's named Thutis. Now, there's no record of such a Pauline disciple anywhere other than from Valentinus. And even if there was, what Valentinus claims he was taught not only finds no basis in the verified writings of the Apostle Paul, but in several of Paul's letters, we find ample evidence that the core ideas of Gnosticism were already afoot, and he categorically rejected them. His letter to the Church at Colossae is an especially poignant one in this regard, as are portions of 1 John, where the Apostle John makes it a point to refute the idea that Jesus did not have a body. Now, earlier I mentioned that one view of Gnosticism said that Jesus and Christ were two separate things, Jesus the man and Christ the spirit. One school of Gnostics said that there was no man named Jesus, that the Christ was merely a phantom, a ghost-like figure who left no footprints, cast no shadow, because he had no physical body. How could he, these Gnostics asked, when all this physical is evil? No, they said, Jesus only seemed, he only appeared to be physical and possess a body. This brand of Gnosticism is called Docetism and is one of the earliest forms of Gnosticism. Docetism comes from the word meaning to seem. Now, Gnostics of every stripe agreed that the supreme God, the Father God of the New Testament, well, he could not be the creator of the physical universe because he's perfect in holiness. And so he couldn't create something so unalterably evil. No, this supreme God, they say, gave rise to lesser spiritual emanations called archons, who in turn gave rise to their own spiritual emanations. And then we have a repeated cycle of spiritual generation until there is a spirit far enough away from the source that was sufficiently distant to create the universe and earth. Called the Demiurge, Gnostics cast this as the God of the Old Testament. Now, on earth, the Demiurge created people, humans, of course, some of whom at random possessed sparks of the divinity drawn from an earlier archon named Sophia, wisdom. And with proper nurture, that spark could be fanned into the flame of Gnostic enlightenment. Where Gnosticism thrived was in the North African city of Alexandria, the Roman Empire's second largest and a highly influential city. Especially in the realm of philosophy, Alexandria was a center of culture and learning, and Gnosticism's presence there greatly advanced its reach. The arid conditions of North Africa also facilitated the preservation of documents. So, some of our most ancient manuscripts of the New Testament come from that region. Some conservative scholars believe that these manuscripts bear evidence of Gnostic tampering, and that they tend to exclude portions of the gospel that reference Jesus' corporeal existence, as well as those parts of the epistles which speak of the life of faith affecting the physical world. But the net result of Gnosticism on the church was the clarification of what Orthodox Christians believe about the humanity and the deity of Christ and the nature of faith. Gnostic challenges moved church leaders to identify which books were scripture, as well as what makes for essential doctrine. Though the cause of orthodoxy was advanced by confronting Gnosticism, Gnostic ideas became entrenched in some churches, and by the early 4th century, when Christianity was finally removed from under the heel of imperial persecution, church leaders in some places were split over some of the ideas that Gnosticism had inserted. As suggested earlier, ancient promoters of Gnosticism were adept marketers. They took a little from here, a little from there, a bit more from over yonder. They put it all in a bowl and made a kind of, well, religious salad. And then they applied the coup de grace, the dressing of Christian terminology. They took the words of orthodoxy, poured different meanings into them. Words like salvation, gospel, even Jesus. They shared the Christian vocabulary, but they had a different dictionary. And it seems that we're watching a replay of the past. It isn't that ancient Gnosticism is being revived so much as the methodology of its ancient promoters has been adopted by advocates of what is called progressive Christianity. Progressive Christianity is neither progressive nor Christian. It's nothing but a reheated version of 19th century's theological liberalism that gutted mainline denominations, emptied churches, and turned cathedrals into museums and breweries. But progressivism draws people in because it's well marketed. It's appealing on a number of fronts. It accepts the secular worldview that now dominates Western culture. It clings to the unshakable inner sense that there must be more to life than just biology. There has to be some larger purpose and meaning to our being here. But it aligns with the world's morality by adopting the idea the evolution of humanity can only take place when we all go along to get along. And then it wraps all of that in the words that the church has used for 2,000 years. As with ancient Gnostics, the vocabulary of progressivism is the same as classic evangelicalism, but its dictionary is different. I remember hearing an interesting discussion on the radio some years ago. The Pope was visiting the United States, and a group of liberal Catholics had petitioned to meet with him to formally declare their belief that the Roman Church needed to start ordaining women priests. So one of the representatives was there on that radio discussion. The other person was a conservative priest stating his opposition to the ordination of women priests. And the advocate for ordination based his position on the contention that the church needs to adapt to the times and accommodate modern societal norms and values. Though he didn't use those exact words, his position was, you know, the church needs to get with the times. Now, while I don't go along with the whole Roman Catholic idea of a specially sanctioned priesthood, I had to cheer the conservative priest's reply. He said that the church isn't called to get with the times. It's to safeguard and promote the faith that is once for all delivered to the saints. It's called to hold fast to those things that the church has always taught, not bow to the pressure of an ever-changing fad and fashion of this world. God doesn't change. How could he and remain perfect? If God doesn't change, then issues of faith can't either. Morality can't change because it's not based on human preference or society. It's based on the nature and the character of God as our creator. Now, what Christians believe today, it has to sync up with what they have believed since the earliest days of the church. Progressive Christianity is errant on its surface in that it regards itself as progressive. It's moved on from what Christianity was to something else, something other. And that other is decidedly not biblical historical Christianity. So be on guard against teachers who confidently assert that they found reasons to set aside what Christians have always believed and come up with new interpretations of the Bible and belief that conveniently align with this fallen world. As James says in verse 4 of chapter 4 of his epistle, "Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." The popular author Dan Brown made a splash some years ago with his best-selling novel, The Da Vinci Code. Brown made no secret of his hope that the book would renew interest in what he believed was the real Christianity of Gnosticism. Echoing the silly tropes of a handful of avant-garde alternative history advocates, Brown said that Gnosticism was the original faith of the apostles, but that the Emperor Constantine, for purely political reasons, had hijacked the church and started Roman Catholicism. Well, that was all a lot of hogwash, but it generated a spate of articles and magazines who all mentioned the Gnostic Gospel of Judas that gives Jesus' betrayer a makeover, turning Judas from a fiend into the hero of Jesus' story. In almost everything in the Gospel of Judas turns traditional Christian orthodoxy on its head. Judas is turned from a villain to hero because he helped Jesus' divine spark be liberated from the prison of his body by turning him over to the authorities, a plan that Jesus asked Judas to enact. The Gospel of Judas is typical of all Gnostic writings in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, and it's liberal quoting of those books that end up as part of the New Testament canon, showing that they were already understood by the church as normative for faith and practice.